Please be aware that this podcast has reference to drug and alcohol use and paraphernalia and may not be appropriate for some people in early recovery. Hello everyone, my name is Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
And I am Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And we hope you are enjoying our Treat Addiction podcast. The information in this podcast cannot replace your seeking a treatment provider, which you can easily do at SAMHSA's national helpline at findtreatment.gov or 1-800-622-4357. We wanted to start our podcast with opioids due to the opioid epidemic, and we dedicated 3 episodes to it. And since alcohol continues to kill at epidemic proportions, it is really important that we address it, don't you think?
Definitely. It's all around us.
It really is. Every occasion seems drenched in alcohol, no pun intended. Excessive drinking cost the U.S. $249 billion with a B in 2010.
That is a lot of money. By the DSM 5 criteria of alcohol use disorder, unhealthy alcohol use ranges from using that puts patient at risk of health consequences to use causing multiple medical and or behavioral problems. We're talking about liver disease along with other gastrointestinal issues, marriage issues, parenting and other relationship problems, to legal problems, and the list goes on.
Indeed, the list goes on. And after that comes risky alcohol use, which is a step ahead of unhealthy alcohol use. And people on this path can go on to develop full-blown alcohol use disorder.
You know, people have their own definitions and opinions. So from a scientific point, what is risky alcohol use?
So the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, or NIAAA, has defined risky alcohol use, and they say that in men under 65, it is more than 14 drinks a week or more than 4 drinks at a time. And in women of any age or men over 65, risky alcohol use is more than 7 drinks in a week or more than 3 drinks at a time.
You know, a lot of people even now are thinking,
counting
on their fingers. I'm glad we're making the time to clear this on our podcast. But it also depends on the drink that they drink, right?
Yeah, and I think to separate that is really important because a standard drink is considered 14 grams of ethanol, and that sounds too technical. So that kind of converts to 5 ounces of wine, 12 ounces of beer, or 1.5 ounces of 80-proof spirits. And of course, in pregnant women, even a much lower level of drinking would be considered risky.
I know many people even now are thinking to themselves, okay, this could be me. Often people minimize their alcohol use. They say things like, I only drink a few beers. So if this is risky use, what is binge drinking?
Yeah, binge drinking is really important. And we again take the definition from the NIAAA, and they define it as drinking so much within about 2 hours that the blood alcohol concentration goes to 0.08.
Wow. I was thinking, it reminded me of a gentleman that he definitely met criteria for a binge drinker. This gentleman only drank maybe 3 or 4 times a year, but every time he drank, something invariably would go wrong. For example, on one vacation, he thought, you know, I'm just going to get me a few beers. I'm going to sit by the pool and I'm going to sit there and drink it. Once it's over, it's over. I'm not going to drink anymore. That made sense to him, but he forgets that the alcohol reduced his inhibition. And then he made bad decisions, and then he went and sought more. And on another occasion, he drank such that he was pulled over, and this was his second or third time, and he had to have an orange license plate, and he had to drive with it, but he was a teacher, so he didn't want to be seen with the plate on the school grounds. So he had to compel his wife to drive him to work every day for the year because of his drinking. And he was a binge drinker. He didn't drink every day. He was very functional. So when does it become full-blown alcohol use disorder?
That really is a good question. And the answer, as usual, is complicated because under DSM-5, we have now specific criteria for the definition of an addictive disorder. In alcohol use disorder, we need 2 of 11 criteria over 1 year to make the diagnosis.
So I think many people are going to be looking at their fingers and counting 2 pretty quickly, right? Some important criteria to keep in mind for them is that alcohol is used in larger amounts over a longer period than was intended. So they wanted to just have a few beers, and before they know it, they've had a couple of six-packs. They have unsuccessful efforts to cut down. They've tried, but they cannot seem to cut down.
Yeah.
They crave it. They have issues with continuing to use and to drink this beverage despite relationship and work or school problems.
And I've noticed, you know, in addiction medicine, that the simpler ones, which are standard across the board in the criteria listing, are criteria number 10 and number 11. And they're really simple to remember because in addiction, there are 2 things that happen very reliably. And one of them is tolerance, in which the person needs more and more alcohol to get intoxicated. And the second is withdrawal. So the symptoms of withdrawal from a particular addictive substance are pretty characteristic. And we will talk about the alcohol withdrawal in a minute.
And also with DSM-5, is the newer version, the terminology for everyone now is alcohol use disorder. We don't use the term alcohol abuse or dependence as we used to in the past. Those terms are no longer used. And I had a case I was going to share, but I'm going to omit it for now because I might just go on and on with it. But
Okay. A discussion in patients with alcohol use disorder gets, I notice this in my patients, and I'm sure people notice it in their families and friends as well, that the person gets very defensive. And this is kind of like very particular for alcohol. It doesn't really happen with other addictive substances, but specifically with alcohol, they get very defensive. And therefore, when we take the history, another thing that they do is that they minimize. So we have a maxim in addiction medicine that alcohol users minimize and cocaine users maximize. They get, the stimulant makes them kind of grandiose. And we have this thing that if they say, you know, I drink such and so much in a week or in a day, we tend to multiply that by 2.
It's absolutely true. And in fact, it brings to my mind a gentleman that I'm currently seeing and minimized his alcohol use. After 3 years of seeing him, he was recently admitted inpatient. This is when I find out that he was having issues with alcohol use after his inpatient treatment, 3 years into treatment. So yeah, they minimize or omit it completely. How many people in the U.S. do you think have, or have you seen in the literature, struggle with alcohol use disorder?
Yeah, the number is kind of like upsetting because over age 12, there are, in 2022, we noticed there were 29.5 million people, or 10.5% of the population, used alcohol. And I'm very grateful that we have listeners across the world because I want to kind of like widen it and explain that as far as addiction is concerned, it crosses all boundaries of race, ethnicity, profession, and religion. And I published a review article on Pakistan's opioid, alcohol, and methamphetamine epidemic. And it would surprise people to know that in a country where the predominant religion, Islam, forbids alcohol, there is in fact a significant number of people abusing it, which again boils down to the importance of receptors and the many factors that work together to create an addiction. And regardless of whether a person's religion or society or family tell the person not to use drugs or alcohol, the track of the disease is determined by the person's biology, their genes, and the environment.
Unfortunately. So what are some of the risk factors for alcohol use disorder?
There are many, but the bigger, the main ones are male gender, age 18 to 29, Native American and white ethnicity, any significant disability, other substance use disorder because, they tend to go hand in hand, and mood disorders like major depression and bipolar disorder. And of course, there are genetic risk factors.
Genetic factors also, it's very prevalent in alcohol use disorders, aren't they?
They really are. They did a large population study, and this was really quaint, but I love twin studies. It was done in Virginia of 3,516 male-male twins, and it was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry in 1999. And it showed the outsized influence of genetics in alcohol use disorder because of the similarity of use among identical twins versus fraternal twins. So very interesting.
And these same factors also play an important role in relapse, don't they?
Yeah, and a relapse is really where the sad part is. We had a patient we used to call the Blue Man because his arms were completely tattooed. And in treatment, he had had several entries into treatment, and he had achieved sobriety, and then he relapsed. And this last time I asked him, I said, tell me what happened. And he said, I was doing great. And I just went to deliver something to a friend's house, and there was this single, solitary, cold beer sitting on the breakfast bar. And that's all he remembered, because he picked it up, and he, like you mentioned in the previous one, you know, it one or just a few, you know, milliliters leads on to more and more and more. Mm-hmm. He really had a very strong family history of alcohol use disorder, and it again also illustrates the importance of total abstinence, whether it is drugs or alcohol, for even a small amount can slip the person into the throes of addiction again. And I like to say, to kind of like illustrate to patients, that we need to keep the receptors asleep and the brain and drug and alcohol free.
But sometimes people think, I can do just one.
Yes,
just,
yes. Just one. That invincibility of addiction.
Yeah, that's
yes.
Like having one chip.
Mm-hmm.
Or one Oreo cookie.
One chip. I like that.
Yeah. You know, I can also appreciate why you like calling alcohol use disorder the little sister of diabetes, because of how many other systems it affects.
It really does, and the list is very burdensome, and I didn't want our audience to go to sleep. So I just chose the important ones, like the real, real important ones. And it can cause high blood pressure, heart disease, and the very famous one which people know about is liver disease. And I try to explain to patients about the stages of liver disease in people with alcohol use disorder. So first, there's swelling of the liver with fat deposition in it, or we call it alcohol-induced fatty infiltration. And then there's inflammation or alcohol-induced hepatitis, in which there's inflammation going on. And then the liver shrinks down, and this is cirrhosis. And when it shrinks down, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And thereafter, there is liver failure. Alcohol use disorder can also cause dementia or memory loss, pancreatitis, which is an extremely painful condition with a lot of abdominal and back pain. And recurrent pneumonia, because the person passes out and then they aspirate all of the germs and they develop pneumonia. And it also causes many cancers, especially of the mouth, the gullet or the esophagus, the throat, liver, and breast. So these are really the prominent physical symptoms. And like I said, the list was long. I kind of shortened it. There are important psychiatric symptoms too, aren't there?
Indeed. But even with, especially with depression and anxiety, there's this interplay between the two. Some people who are depressed, they drink to feel better, not realizing that the alcohol actually makes them feel more depressed. And some people drink to quench or quench their anxiety, and then it can also make them feel more anxious. It's also involved in eating disorders and various other addictions, and also sleep problems. Interestingly enough, so many people drink to help them go to sleep, but it can also affect the sleep architecture. So we have to be very, very aware in trying to teach people what they're trying to treat is also causing them to have more problems. But alcohol use disorder has a very high mortality rate also, doesn't it?
It does, and it's really important to remember that the two addictions and withdrawal from which can cause death are alcohol and benzodiazepines like Xanax and Ativan and Valium, because the person, the old term, and a lot of people are familiar with it, is that the person goes into, we call it alcohol withdrawal now, alcohol withdrawal syndrome, AWS, but it used to be called delirium tremens, in which the person has a severe tremor and they are not conscious, and then they have seizures followed by death. Mm-hmm. So the sad part is that it is a preventable cause of death, and excessive alcohol consumption became the third leading preventable cause of death. And I think the key piece is the preventable part, that if you have something that that cannot be prevented, that's one thing. But if something can be prevented, you know, it should be. And more than 140,000 deaths a year in the United States are directly attributed to alcohol use. And the deaths are caused by suicide, physical conditions that alcohol use disorder causes, like we mentioned, especially heart disease, fatal accidents like traffic accidents and driving with an elevated alcohol level above 0.08. And this was very interesting. The risk of drowning in people with alcohol use disorder is 3.5 times higher than people that don't drink. And originally, I immediately went to Whitney Houston, but when I confirmed it, her cause of death was not alcohol directly, it was cocaine. But the British singer and songwriter Amy Winehouse, now it's so ironic that the last name is Winehouse. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was like, oh, wow. She died of alcohol intoxication at the very young age of 27.
Yeah.
And she had started drinking at age 12.
Sadly, some people, even as they listen to this podcast, will dismiss, minimize their use and think,
yes,
you know, this is not going to happen to
me. But it's important for families.
Yes.
You know,
yeah, to have this under control. Yeah. So what is the physical exam for a person with alcohol use disorder?
So depending on the severity, it can be completely normal, or when the person is in withdrawal, there can be tremor, which reminds me of a patient I saw recently who had come requesting treatment with Vivitrol, which we will discuss in the next episode. He had a long and strong history of alcohol use to the point that he was not in withdrawal because he had been in a treatment facility for very long. The alcohol had damaged his cerebellum so much, the base of his brain, which controls movement, that he had a full body tremor. And it was like amazing to see. There can also be agitation, confusion, and features of advanced liver disease, like the palms can become very red. We call it palmar erythema. Mm-hmm. Or they can be spider angiomata, like little clumps of blood vessels. And, of course, there can be liver or spleen enlargement, among a plethora of other things.
But in alcohol use disorder, you have different levels as well.
Yes, just like the other addictions. And this is what I love about medicine and about how sort of organized and categorized we are, that we have severity. We call it the addiction severity index, and it is based on the criteria. And so if it's mild alcohol use disorder, there are 2 to 3 criteria present. If it's moderate, there are 4 to 5. And if there are severe, there are 6 or more.
So as I said before, though, there are people just counting toes and fingers to see how many criteria can they check off their list. Almost a mile. I don't have a problem. It's very mild. I only have 2 or 3. So what's the usual course of alcohol use disorder?
So at a given time, 40% are in remission and 24% are kind of like at the same level that they were. And 30%, which is quite a bit, have progressed to more severe disease.
So what do we do for this very serious problem?
So there are 2 things. The first is we need to screen, which should be done in primary care offices. There's a single item questionnaire, which is how many times in the past year have you had 5? And for women, 4 or more drinks in a day. And a positive response, beat this, is a score of 1.
Uh-oh. So you know what that means?
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone should come see us.
And the other questionnaire, which I have used all through the years, is the CAGE questionnaire. Very simple, works very, very well. And the C is for, do you feel you should cut down drinking? The A is, do you feel annoyed if you're criticized for drinking? The G is for, do you feel guilty that you drink? And the E is, do you drink first thing in the morning, like an eye opener? And a score of even 1 positive. So you ask the person this, and if they respond by an affirmative, a yes to even 1, there is a problem. There are other longer screening tools, but this is something that's kind of simple to do, the single item and then the CAGE. The second thing that we should do is treatment, and we will address that in the next episode.
I'd like to also underscore the ease of use of the CAGE question. Within less than a minute,
yeah,
you can screen, and then you can capture someone who may need or respond to a recommendation for treatment, yes. I think it's a good idea to pause here as well, because we really did pack quite a bit of information, which people need to spend a minute to digest so they can understand the next one, which would be about treatment.
We hope that you are enjoying our podcast series. Please subscribe and share the podcast with family and friends. You can listen on wgte.org/treataddiction or anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for Treat Addiction. It is only through awareness and education that we can tackle the very treatable disease of addiction. I want to thank my co-host, Dr. Ketley Daniels, for a great discussion today. I'm your host and producer, Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
I am your co-host, Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And our executive producer extraordinaire is Chris Pfeiffer. Until the next episode, do remember, patience in difficult times and gratitude always. We hope to meet again soon.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.